yeah. Welcome to the Soulcast. Today's guest is Cindy Milstein. Cindy Milstein is a longtime anarchist organizer, author, thinker, involved with the Institute for Anarchist Studies, and has published a couple books, namely Anarchism and Its Aspirations, and most recently, Rebellious Morning. And that is mainly what we're going to be talking about in this interview, is her new book, Rebellious Morning, which is out on AK Press. The book is a collection of essays and pieces from people all over the world, just kind of investigating different aspects of our personal stories of grief and mourning, and kind of opens up the conversation of how have other people used mourning as part of a healthier form of resistance, and how can it inform our daily life and in our organizing efforts. And aside from all that, it just gives you such a sharp glimpse into the lives of so many people in so many different struggles, and probably a lot of perspectives and things that, I mean, I never thought about until I read the book. So I highly recommend the book. It comes at a critical time when, you know, we're experiencing just nothing but loss, it feels like. So check out this interview, pick up the book, and if you have any feedback about it, you know, shout us out on social media or pop me an email at soul@soulone.org. And as usual, this show is funded by the generous contributions of listeners. So if you want to support the Soulcast, you can sign up for our Patreon, or you can go to soulone.org/support and support in other ways. This show is a proud member of the Channel Zero Podcast Network. So before we begin with this interview, we will hear from some of our homies in the network.
How can we imagine a world beyond prisons and police, borders and surveillance?
Rust Belt Abolition Radio is an abolitionist media and movement building project based in Detroit, Michigan.
Each monthly episode amplifies the voices of those impacted by mass incarceration and explores ongoing work in the movement to abolish the carceral state and racial capitalism.
Tune in to Rust Belt Abolition Radio here on the Channel Zero Network and visit www.rustbeltradio.org to learn more.
Yeah. This is M1, M.A. Uno, M.A. de la gente comprende y entiende, you feel me? I'm one half of Dead Prez, to tell it like it is, everything is political rap duo. Here holding my middle finger up to imperialism worldwide. And you in tune right now to the rebel beat.
The Rebel Beat is a monthly podcast of radical political music across different genres and across different continents. It's the mixtape to a riot against police brutality. It's your nightly newscast set to bass and beats. It's protest anthems from Hong Kong to Istanbul to Ferguson to Montreal. Give it a listen at rebelbeatradio.com or subscribe today on all your favorite podcast platforms.
Cindy Milstein, welcome to the Soulcast.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We've been fucking emailing back and forth for like literally 6 months now, so it's good to finally get a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's funny because when I first started digging into your work, I was reading your classic anarchism book, and then like right as I finished it and we were getting ready to do the interview, you dropped this other book, and I was like, oh shit, better. Because you don't want to be talking about old stuff all the time, you know.
Yeah.
So how's life? How are you doing these days?
You know, okay. What's like relatively given the world we live in, which hard to be okay in or hard to be okay with, but yeah.
Yeah, totally. Well, you have a new, book out called Rebellious Morning. It's a very powerful, amazing book. I highly recommend it. And, you know, I mean, I just have some basic questions about it. So my first one is, you know, as a longtime anarchist organizer, why did you feel like it was necessary to making this book?
Yeah, I mean, the book is an anthology. And originally, I was going to write a whole book myself on loss and grief and sort of through an anarchist lens. And because I'd been experiencing a lot personally and kind of felt a loss of non-religious faith in anarchist circles to sort of be there with at least me through the whole of life, sort of ups and downs and losses especially. And so part of the impulse originally was me knowing that, wow, I'm an anarchist and I believe in these values and I'm watching people who aren't anarchists practice them in relation to me when I was experiencing a lot of loss. But yet I felt like by and large, not some individuals were great, but by and large, the sort of anarchist world that I had been inhabiting for a long time and feel like is my community sort of didn't seem like it had the capacity or tools or skills or time or all these other things to sort of deal with the whole of life, which includes death and other really profound losses. So that was sort of one thing that led me to it. But over time in turning it into an anthology, I think what's really drawn me to it, I feel like more and more, like if I want people to be, if they choose to be anarchists, which I hope people do, and less about the word than about looking at the world through a lens that finds and hates hierarchy and wants to replace it with forms of non-hierarchy, which would look like care and love and mutual aid and dignity and empathy and self-organization and a whole bunch of other beautiful values, that I think in order to stay an anarchist over the long haul, which has really perplexed me why people don't, is one needs to be able to get through a lot of losses. Many human beings, or most human beings right now, are experiencing profound losses in the world repetitively. I think as anarchists, we have this utopian vision in the best sense of the word, and we will probably never live to see the day when all the dreams and all the ways we would understand society to be reorganized come to fruition. So one has to figure out how to deal with loss and grief and mourning well in a way that allows you to be rebellious through it and have the rebelliousness envelope it in the same fabric that we do everything else in. And so part of it's this sort of, I feel like the more we actually recognize that we're going to sustain losses, both personally and especially politically, and grapple with better ways to mourn them and grieve them together collectively, we'll actually get through it better and give those losses meaning and see that there's not just pure wins and losses, but gradations of beautiful things that we get in the process of winning and losing. So that was one thing. The other second thing I think is that we're, as anarchists, deeply human people. We're people too. And we are going to experience loss as human beings. And there's something deeply humanizing at moments when people are experiencing profound loss. They tend to kind of often be fully their most human and real, and which can be messy and hard, but some of the best qualities can sometimes come out. So that's another reason I want to work on this book. And I guess the last thing is I've really been heartened to see there's kind of this turn among anarchists of, I think, moving more toward categories of care and mutual aid in the organizing we do, and not understanding anarchism as a thing. You've got to be really hard and tough and, militant, meaning only you can be hard and tough. And I want to be militantly caring. I've been really seeing that. One really touching example, for instance, was a young anarchist I met fairly recently who said they'd been doing a lot of like what we would understand to be more like, defensive, community self-defense around fascists and white supremacists. And they were like, oh, it was really tough and really hard. And then they went to Charlottesville and were around the car when Heather Heyer was murdered. And they said that really was kind of this epiphany, is like, here was this moment where it felt like they had won as an anarchist and an anti-fascist, and yet everybody was so hurt and broken. And so they were telling me how since then they and their community has really focused on what does it look like to incorporate the world we want to see instead of just being everything we're against and feeling. And so they're doing a lot of solidarity projects, whether that's legal and jail solidarity to, you know, healing practices to, a bunch of other ways where we emphasize the ways we end up taking care of each other. And then we can actually stand up, I feel like, better to the forces that are trying, that we are decrying, because we actually have communities of care that sustain us through those things. So long-winded answer to just say, I feel like this category just like, a deeply human things that could potentially make all of us and anarchism and the politics we do far more appealing and caring and real and genuine, rehumanize us right now in a world where people feel really cut off from each other.
Yeah. Absolutely. I feel like, it's that the, I guess the reason why this book spoke to me so much is because I'm like, right when the book came out, I was like, feel like I've dealt with so much death in the past few years. Especially through, like, you know, I got active around Occupy, and so I came in touch with a lot of people who, you know, who were not necessarily homeless, but some homeless people and people who have it a little harder than your average college student, let's say. Average privileged college student. And I feel like the more, you know, the more in contact, you know, I get, the more, you know, the more I find out about friends just dying in different ways, you know, and I don't know, it reminds, and I thought of that book, I don't know if you've read this book, but Speaker for the Dead by Orson Scott Card. Do you know this book?
Oh no, I'm going to write it down.
It's, you know, the book Ender's Game.
Mm-hmm.
So like after Ender's Game, like they wipe out all the aliens, and then the kid Ender, he thought it was a video game and decides, this is a side tangent, I guess. But then he decides he didn't realize he was committing mass murder. And then he becomes the speaker for the dead and goes around and just carries these stories of, I don't know. That's what this book evoked to me, is the speaker for the dead.
Well, I hope we all, I don't know. I feel more and more, I keep saying this when I do events around the book, but I never really believed sort of in ghosts, or they seem like kind of cartoony, but I feel like after experiencing a lot of also, being with and watching people die, good and bad deaths, and experiencing a lot of other losses, I'm just really aware more than ever of all the ghosts around us, you know, and the ghosts that, you know, and all the land that's been stolen, and centuries of ghosts of people that resisted and were experienced genocide or enslavement or extermination. And I think it's good that we have those people around us and those stories around us. And so I don't know, I really do sort of feel like this book, it has like 37 different voices in it. And I really, really encouraged everybody. I really wanted people to write pieces that in a sense we're telling stories that were really from their heart, and that held the bittersweetness of what it means to like love and lose. because I know, like, I don't know, grief seems like a heavy topic, but I feel like it's just a very human thing. We're just structured, you know, as humans, we're born knowing we're going to die. And that's such a profound kind of loss. And, but the only things we grieve are things we love. So I actually think grief is like such a beautiful category to remember and hold on to. And if we are actually aware of speaking for the dead that we love, we're speaking love, which is why, yeah. I feel like ultimately this book is speaking about love. Not saying it's uplifting. I asked everybody not to find like closure with their stories or sort of endings, but the process of what it means to continue to keep love alive and to grieve and to grapple with what that means is more interesting to me. Cause I think the minute I don't hope I never stop grieving all the people that have died in my life that I love, cause then it would mean I'd forgotten them and don't love them anymore.
Right. So, sorry.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, and I feel like the writing, and that's funny that's like an intention there, because like opening up that gray area sort of, it leaves so much room for nuance, because As you were talking, I was recalling, I think it was like a disabled rights activist in Ontario, that chapter, where, you know, there was like this, they were experiencing just this range of emotions, like even though like creating all these alternatives, you know, care circles and stuff, it's still hard to ask for help, but then also yep. like recognizing like all these other layers of privilege and pain I feel like it's one thing to read about these struggles. But I feel like what this book also does, in addition to opening up a conversation about grief, it's just a window of empathy into all these different ways of being, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's so many different stories in it. And there were others that didn't make it in because it's also really hard to write about one's own grief in both personal and ways that were political. Cause that's the book does both. But that particular piece by AJ Withers, they were experiencing, and they do, chronic health issues and different disabilities or ability differences. And while they were writing it, and it took a long time to struggle through that piece, and then they were with me at one of the conversations about the book in Toronto, and I was just really struck. And they said this publicly, so I'm not saying anything they didn't say, but they were like, wow, I just reread my piece before this talk tonight. And I'd forgotten a couple things that I had said in it, because while I was writing it, they were also taking different pharmaceuticals for some of the chronic pain they were experiencing. And they hadn't remembered writing some of what they'd written, including some things that they thought they never really wanted to share publicly yet. And then they did again share it publicly. And I feel like a lot of the pieces, they're just so beautiful and honest and raw. And they ended up, all of us that contributed ended up, I think, having that feeling of experiencing about opening oneself up more than one even planned to in the writing, and then later in conversations when I brought the book into spaces. And I've just been really struck. I have done a lot of sort of different kind of talks around other books and topics in over the years. And with this book, I think I've done over 30 sort of talks, and then I open up space for people to share similar stories. And other times when I do anarchist talks, there's someone that will monologue or be disrespectful, or people will interrupt each other, or people won't be nice to each other sometimes. And I've just been, every single one of these I've done, people have been so beautifully empathetic to each other and respectful and listened intently and teared up and showed their emotions and not checked themselves from showing their emotions. And people have shared things time and time again where afterward they're like, wow, I didn't think I would be up to sharing that, but I felt like it was okay to be brave with everybody else right now. And I just feel like that's what I wanted. It's separate from this book. I mean, I do books because to me they're political interventions, and this one felt very personal too, but I feel like the intervention I wanted was, I feel like we really need to have these spaces where we are allowed to be fully human and emotional and see that we can be empathetic and respectful and caring toward each other. Because right now I feel like partly society is ripping everybody apart, and we as human beings end up taking that on and just start emulating those behaviors and ripping each other apart in a lot of ways, whether online or, you know, and I don't think it's anything special to anarchist communities that were particularly worse than any other communities. It's just that, you know, society tends to increasingly fragment us and isolate us and make us think we're out having to compete with each other, and everyone feels precarious and scared and anxious, but yet we're told that we're the only ones that feel like that, or to hide it away and lash out at others. And I've just really been struggling when we create spaces intentionally where we want to create a different culture, that people are so, myself included, just so desperately want that, need that, to understand that we have the capacity to be this way. We know we can. So I've just been really struck by that. And AJ's piece is one of those. It was like, it was a really hard piece for AJ to write. And you can see the tensions of them grappling with things that are hard. And then they did the same thing again when they spoke about it in person.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, that piece in particular, I actually got it. I mean, cause I had just had a baby. And so when I was reading about the care circles, I was like, what the fuck? Why don't we set up a phone care circle for our baby with all of our homies on it? Like, I mean, of course that would be obvious to other people, but that was, you know, it's hard. Yeah. It's hard to ask for help. But one thing that just another thing I was thinking about is, like, right after Trump got elected, we held these big autonomous assemblies here in Denver. And, you know, there was like, you know, whatever, 90% of the people I'd never seen before in my life, like pissed off Bernie supporters, you know, all these people. And, you know, we were like, oh, we're going to do this thing on J20. We're going to do this. And so we, like, agreed on, you know, doing a couple actions. And then after a while, all those new people just disappeared. And when I was talking with a friend about it, who comes from a more permaculture background, you know, they were like, you know, of course that didn't go anywhere. Like, there's no foundation there. Like, you just got a bunch of random people in a room and expected everybody to make a revolution. You know, like, we have to be more intentional about, you know, creating communities of resistance and actually building, like, community. And, like, I was like, I don't even know what that means, to be honest. You know, food. And so, and again, it just reminds me of how, like, this holistic emotional element is, like, you know, we ignore it at our own peril, and we wonder why people burn out and disappear. And I think this plays a huge role in it. So I guess my question for you would be, like, in our organizing, how can we open up a space for such things without it being, like, self-aggrandizing or mopey or just stale, where it becomes a formula, where, you know what I mean? Like, how, like, have you talked or thought about, like, how we as radical organizers could incorporate a more of this sort of approach, more of a holistic, empathetic approach that that opens us up more?
Yeah. Well, I feel like I'm partially what I'm hoping, like, in the anthology, it's arguing that one of the arguments, I think, is that right now in this world, like, most humans are experiencing, like, profound form. We're at, like, one of those crossroad moments when the impact and amount of loss is super intense and escalating quickly, whether that's the idea that humans might be extinct from climate change and just a quote extreme weather that's, you know, now becoming normal weather, to, you know, you go to school and someone walks in and kills a bunch of people, you know, all the things, to people are getting evicted and can barely figure out where to go next because the rent's high, or all these things where I think so many people just feel this intense, just grinding sense of loss. And in the Trump's election, I noticed here in Michigan, people where I live, people in this part of the Midwest are super, by and large, chatty and talk to each other. You know, if you walk down the street, people say hi to each other. And that ends up being, you know, at some point, people are very pretty genuinely talkative to each other. And a lot of people just talk to strangers. And, but, you know, you kind of have that perfunctory, like, hey, how are you? Good, fine. And I noticed after Trump's election, for instance, you could just see in everybody's eyes that nobody was fine. And I wasn't surprised that Trump was elected. But I was surprised how intense I felt afterward. And I think it was because I was looking in everybody's eyes and it was just picking up on, like, everybody feels like they've been just slammed by and then I noticed that nobody really wanted, people wanted to talk to each other, but they didn't want to just say, hey, how are you? Good. And it was a shift that happened for a couple months, which I thought was really beautiful, is people would just look at each other and go, wow, it's really hard. And then, you know, you could say, yeah. And then you could continue talking, or I've been really depressed. Yeah, me too. And then you could continue talking. And so that's just a tiny thing, but I think it, to me, is the beginning of pointing is, like, this anthology or the political work I do, I think when we start thinking of politics as instrumental, like, wow, now Trump's, you know, gotten elected, this is a good moment where we can you know, there's a bunch of new people. We can instrumentally make them do our politics or bring them into a movement. And as opposed to be like, wow, there's a bunch of other people who feel, you know, confused or hurt or angry or sad or mobilized or all these emotions that are overwhelmed with rageful. And we're all coming together. How can we like acknowledge that, like that feeling together verbally and how we look at each other and talk to each other and in non-instrumental ways out of that shared sense of these collective moments of suffering or grief or anger. And actually I feel like grief and anger is a very legitimate and very well documented emotion of grief. You know, so it's, you know, we get angry when police murder someone. And, I've been really struck by some of my friends who've been like, oh, you know, when we're in the street, they say we're, I've heard a few of my friends say this lately, which I really like. Cause like, you know, the newspapers always say, oh, people are rioting incoherently. They don't, you know, when a cop shoots someone, they don't know what they want. And people are like, no, we know what we want. We want a world without police where they can't just murder people three or four times a day and nothing happens. But we're also sad. We're out there angry because we're sad. We don't want this to keep happening. And so how do you non-instrumentally come together and create spaces, whether it's assemblies or just spaces to have conversations or social events, fun play events, you know, like where we look at each other and try to actually socialize and be human and understand how we're all doing and feeling. And from there, decide how we want to engage in politics. And instead of kind of rushing in, okay, now we've got an assembly, what are we going to do? As opposed to going like, okay, how are we feeling at this moment? What is drawing us to this moment, what's getting us sad or angry, and getting to know each other. And I feel like we skip over that a lot. We don't understand that, you know, weaving a social fabric is takes work and socializing and social culture. And so part of it is bringing those values as core to the spaces we do. I'm part of an anarchist summer school that's just going to do its second year this summer called the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking, in Worcester, Massachusetts. And, last year was the first experiment and we could have been better organized and we, et cetera. And this year we are, but we were all a little worried about it, but it was such a magical experience because the thing that we decided to foreground, which I just really appreciated, was everybody involved in it, was like, we're going to foreground modeling and practicing and emphasizing qualitatively deep social relationships of care and empathy and mutual aid. And when things come up that are hard, we're going to have conversations about them right away. We're not be direct and, you know, not pretend that things don't happen. But when things happen, create a brave space where we can, in very humane ways, work through them. And I was really struck at the end of that week where almost everybody that came, you know, had a really good learning experience too. But they were all like, wow, I've never been in a space where people would say different things. I've never been in a space where I didn't feel like I was going to be sexually assaulted. This is said, one person said to me, or I've never been in a space where I didn't feel like people were toxic to each other. Or I've never been in a space where people didn't just judge one behavior of mine and then just dismiss the whole of me, you know? So I think they're little things, but if we start practicing, you know, a culture, not just a culture of resistance and not just security culture and but cultures of care, in what we do is completely essential to what we do. I keep using this example when I've been talking about this book, but it's one of the really compelling examples because there's also a film about it from a movement in Spain that was when tens of thousands of people were being evicted because the policy had changed. There was a movement called PAH and they made a film about it called Si Se Puede, 7 Days in the Life of PAH. And each of the 7 days isn't a day, but it's sort of the 7 key pillars of what made that movement really powerful, because hundreds of thousands of people came out and their slogan was no one will not have a home. So they were part of their movement was nobody. If someone gets evicted, we will figure out where they're not going to sleep on the street. So one of the 7 pillars was just like you mentioned, they had an assembly where people decided together what they wanted to do and how they wanted to organize. And that was essential. And another pillar was if someone got evicted, they broke into buildings and squatted empty buildings. And so they created homes for people. So they set up housing squats for people. That was another pillar. And another pillar that was equally important to direct action and self-governance was they had once a week this circles of time when people could come and share what it feels like to lose one's home or to be facing losing one's home. And in the film, I don't know, I'm paraphrasing the film, but there's a kind of neat moment where someone who's in one of the squats who's lost her home, she's like, oh, it's great. You know, I have a home. I'm not on the street, but I still feel really like sad because I lost my home. The squat isn't my home. It's good, but it's still not my home. And so she goes to the, you know, she's like, I'm glad there's a space I can talk about that. And in the space where you can talk about the loss, there's someone who says, oh, I didn't even know there was this movement until after I lost my home. But I came to the space to talk about my loss and I learned how to help squat buildings. And now I'm part of this movement. And so I feel like we're really bad here at being like, how do we integrate the fullness into our political work of our lives? Not just, you know, like the moments when we want to be, you know, tough and go out and stand up to fascists that are coming to our town or organize a demonstration or, you know, come into an assembly and hope we can get all those people to stay in our movement. It's like, how do we on a day-to-day basis think about a sort of everyday anarchism or everyday practices of mutual aid and solidarity and care? And one last example, I've just started this sort of pop-up anarchist social space where I live in a someone's letting me borrow a space for 3 hours a week. And I was originally going to do a bunch of things during it, like programs or talks or things. And then everybody just said, oh, it's so nice just to have a place to come drop in and get to know each other better. And so I've just been really struck by like people just coming in and wanting to chat with each other and ask each other about their lives and their backgrounds. And I've gotten closer to people that I didn't know. And then a couple of weeks ago, Richard Spencer came to town, a town an hour away, and we had a lot of demonstrations and things around that and actually succeeded in ruining the fascist weekend, which was great. But it was pretty intense for a lot of people because most people that came to the demonstration, it was their first demonstration. And there were some scary white supremacists and a lot of scary riot police. And then I did this at the anarchist pop-up social space. People, I just said, oh, why don't whoever wants to come, we'll just have tea and hang out on couches and just talk about how that felt. And it was so beautiful. We ended up, people shared they were having bad dreams or that it was scary or how they felt. But then we just started laughing and having a good time. And I felt, you feel a sense of bonding and closeness. And out of that, I feel like you come out with stronger political movements and people stay and people want to be involved. And so one of the people that came to that informal hangout, he'd been thinking of not even going to the demonstration because he was so scared. And not only through talking and getting to know him and he encouraged a bunch of his other friends to go. And then he came and was talking about his feelings during this. And he was like, oh, the next time this happens, I'm going to get even more people to go. Cause now I feel like it's okay. Cause there's people I can trust. And we did this all together and we looked out for each other and we cared for each other. So it isn't just this instrumental thing. It's like real. We need to have each other's backs. We need care and solidarity. It's not a hokey thing. It's just remembering to be, good people that are creating a good world in a weird way. Cause I think we've sort of sadly forgotten that in a way.
Yeah. And you know, I like your usage of the term instrumental. I've never really heard it used that way. And, it sort of resonates with, you know, Scott Crow, the way he talks about activism, you know, with the capital A activism, like, you know, and, you know, whereas the activist goes into a space and, you know, sometimes this shit can be, you know, can come off or be Machiavellian, you know, even when you don't know it.
No, I actually don't like the word activist because it just feels like you just are kind of like move. And I feel like, you know, organizer who also understands themselves as a caring human being. Maybe a better way to put it, or that we're co-organizing together. I don't know.
Yeah. Cause even organizer implies instrumentalizing. I guess.
Yeah. No. Like, I feel like, how do we just come together as like, I don't know. I even feel like a lot of people always talk about like, oh, we're doing this for those people. And I'm always like, no, you know, we all have things like, I know why I personally want the world to be a different place and why I strive to make it look like that in the here and now, not in some distant future. And we all have, like, if we actually, I think that's another reason why I feel like the category of like us being more open about our loss and our grief and how we work through that is because if you ask anybody, pretty much everybody has had one or two or many profound losses. They just haven't been given the space to share that and talk about that. And often with radicals or political people, those losses are what like drive us. I want to reduce suffering. I want to alleviate those losses. That's one thing that completely impels me in terms of my politics and including my own. I can see a bunch of my own that if there wasn't a world of hierarchy and patriarchy and heteronormativity, for instance, every time my heart got broken, it would still hurt, but it would hurt so much less. I mean, I feel like heteronormativity and patriarchy are what break my heart when I've had heartbreak and have made those breakups so awful. Whereas, you know, where our hearts are going to be broken if we have open hearts and loving hearts, but we're going to be, if we didn't have all this layers of other stuff on top of it. So that's one reason that impels me to be a political person, to not want to have patriarchy and hierarchy, so that I can, you know, just grapple with the heartbreak that I should, not the heartbreak that becomes 90 or 1,000 times more awful. But yeah, so I think that's another non-instrumental way to understand this isn't about other people. This is about all of us, you know, all of us, the suffering that we want to alleviate and the joys and beauty that we all want in the world.
Yeah. It's, like I was saying earlier, I've been in this permaculture course and we just finished it up, but halfway through it, we did a thing on grief with this whole course, we talked about, you know, get into small groups, talk about something that's deeply some grieving that you've gone through that you haven't gotten over, and just like we talked about it in like three phases. And it was like, you know, when I went into this permaculture space, I was like, all right, are these going to be a bunch of like eco sustainability people I don't relate to? Are these going to be a bunch of like foodies? Like, I don't know if I'm going to like anyone in here. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And then like after that, after we did that, like, I was like, wow, I feel closer to these people than people I've been in the streets with for 5 years. You know?
Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And so it really, I mean, all this stuff is really, it's really sinking in for me.
Such a good example of I think permaculture is interesting sometimes, you know, like in essence, the idea that, like, of an ecological whole, an ecosystem. And I feel like, I don't know, so much of our society removes grief from, like, you know, we're supposed to stay young forever and people don't die. We don't see them die. And, you know, we're told that if you grieve too long, it's a mental illness, all these ways in which we're supposed to set grief aside and just be happy. And we take grief out of the ecosystem. Like humans, like I said, we aren't structured to lose as much as we're losing, because capitalism and heteronormativity and patriarchy and the state, they create losses that are so much exponentially more than we as humans should have to bear. But still, we're structured to lose things in you know, our, you know, hearts or people that we love, their bodies when they die. And so, like, I don't know, we've removed ourselves from our own human ecosystem, which is sort of why I keep thinking, you know, like, maybe that's just cool in that permaculture course, because if we actually reintegrate ourselves with birth and death and life and saw it as a cycle, you know, when we die, our bodies become compost for something else, you know, and we're part of an ecosystem. Maybe humanity as a whole wouldn't be destroying its own habitat, its own basis for life. I feel like partially that's sort of also underlying this, is like, we have to reintegrate ourselves with the whole cycle of life. Humans throughout humanity used to see birth and death and, you know, help people be born and bury their dead. And it wasn't something that was odd or weird or set aside. And people had rituals around loss and community celebrations around loss and community, you know, markers around loss and joy and happiness. You know, we made our own holidays and we made our own rituals. I feel like the short time period of human history that we're in right now, compared to the vast majority of human history, we've really been disconnected from our own sort of place in this world and cycles in this world. And that's, you know, showing itself in terms of the fact that not us maybe personally, but humanly made structures are destroying our own basis for life, which is pretty profound. No other animal, I think, destroys its own home. That's pretty profound.
I don't know. I was going to try to think of one. I don't know. My dogs, they'll
maybe your dogs, but they still know you are going to feed them.
Maybe I won't, you know,
that's true.
Well, since you're talking about that, this is something I don't think this was in the book. In your This Is Hell interview, you talked about birth and death as like the only time we're really cared for. And you talked about your experience with your parents in hospice. And that was not in the book, correct?
I put a little bit about hospice in my piece, mostly as a conceptual part. And I just talk a little bit about bringing my dad's death into it a little bit. But yeah, I mean, that originally was another sort of impulse for the book, is having both my parents get sick in a way that I knew they were going to die on the same day, and then end up doing a bunch of caretaking for them for over a year. And they could have died and were dying really bad deaths in the medical industrial complex and through a host of other things. And then I ended up finding hospice, and they ended up having really beautiful deaths, of which I was a part there with them, which I feel really honored to have been. And then I had a third, like, chosen parent who died a couple years after them, and saw her through death too. And I feel really honored. And I've seen a lot of people die really badly, but shot by police or on the street in cities because they don't have places to live. And, you know, I know that people should have deaths, good deaths too, not just good lives because of that. But I did put a little bit about hospice, and not because I think capitalism is going to ruin hospice too, as it becomes a trendy category. But I really like the concept of it, separate from whether capitalism destroys it or not. And I had a good experience where it's sort of like the idea of, I guess we can have uncaring births and uncaring deaths. There are many people that have both. But what I was trying to get at in that interview is that it's the one time when, if people are going to pay more attention and try to be caring, they tend to focus on those two times, and also tend to become, if they're around birth or death, it's so, because we're so removed from it, I think it almost jogs people into opening themselves up in a way and being more human than they are, more caring and more like focused on each other than they are in other situations. What I like about hospice is, as a conceptual thing, is it's asking us to first anticipate that we're going to have a loss, and together form a sort of a circle or community of care in which everybody is mutualistically egalitarian, sort of horizontally looking out for each other. So everybody's kind of caring for each other, and everybody knows everyone's going to experience a loss. We're all anticipating the loss, whether it's the person dying or the person losing the person dying, or people that have relationships that might not make it through that death or get closer. There's all these forms of loss that happen. So anticipatory grief, I think, is really important, because you start to try to figure out ways you're going to support yourself and find care and get through it. And, but when hospice, I really like the values, which really replicate sort of anarchist values to me, sort of simultaneously in the circles and egalitarian communities of care, you try to simultaneously think about how to accentuate the quality of life at every moment for everybody, and how to minimize all unnecessary suffering, which doesn't mean eliminate suffering, because you know you're going to experience a loss. So you what you want to do is eliminate all unnecessary suffering, so you can focus on the loss that you have to focus on, is that someone's going to die. But you can do it in a way that feels so much different than if you saw someone or went through someone dying horribly. So unlike people who've had family members been murdered by police, where they can't hold their body as they're dying, they can't wrap their body afterward or in a cloth, they can't, you know, they can't hold their hand, they can't, you know, give them dignity of like doing, you know, whatever they want just before they die. Like my parents, for instance, at one point, I think my dad wanted his toenails clipped right before he died. And, you know, if he was in a hospital setting, which he was at certain points, they would be like, what does he need his toenails clipped for? He's on life support. He doesn't even know what, you know, he can't even reach his toes. And you're like, why does it matter if he wants his toenails clipped? Why not clip them? It's his dignity. It's his feeling. Right. And so silly, but not silly things like that in hospice is like, if that's a quality of life that someone wants, why wouldn't you do that for someone? Why wouldn't you? Right.
Right.
Why wouldn't you do all these little things that we want for each other? That's caring. And, I feel like it's the most intimate, profound experience I've ever gone through in my life, where I have trouble asking for care. Like you said, a lot of us do. And suddenly when everybody's kind of anticipating loss and trying to think about each other and trying to grapple with it together, you stop thinking about whether you're asking for care or giving care. It just seems to be that everyone's kind of in the loveliest sense of the word, just having each other's backs. And it's just the way, you know, it gets messy too. Some people fall apart and get upset, but even that, people are try to have more empathy toward each other when they're not being as nice to each other. I've just never seen, it's pretty profound. So, I've done talks around this book and conversations, and I've had a lot of people come to these that are do death work or care work or grief work, including a lot of hospice folks. And one woman who does hospice who came to one of my talks was like, she said, "I always say we should all be in hospice for the entirety of our lives because of that." and she was joking, but I think that's what the other secret of death and hospice is you laugh a lot when you're moving toward loss, if you're open about it and caring, because funny things happen and you're not, you know, you laugh, you cry, you scream, you you fall apart, you come together, you do everything that's okay to do. And I think she's right. You know, instead of being like, oh, we should wait till these moments when we're about to experience profound loss to maybe suddenly try to come together, or when we're going to have a child, maybe we should form a circle of care for when our child is an infant. Like, why aren't we doing this for the whole of our lives? Why aren't we thinking about what would it look like to accentuate quality of life and alleviate unnecessary suffering always? Like, shouldn't that sort of be a premise of what we do?
Right. Yeah. I mean, when I was listening to that This Is Hell interview, I just had this image in my head of the hospice of like this Bahamas beach resort or something, you know, like people living in a village. And, you know, it's like, you know, we're so alienated and we're living in such a unnatural way, you know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, childcare, you know, it was like thousands of dollars and, you know, all the, like these things that should just be woven into our lives, you know? Because if I was living in a village, you know, my grandmother would be able to hang out with my kid and then they're both taking care of each other, you know?
Yep. Yep. That's, I mean, I feel like what hospice, you know, in a way, like separate it, I wish it didn't just apply to when people are 6 months away from dying, and it didn't just apply to losses that are death, because loss is such a enormous category. And in this anthology, I tried to show it, like, there's not just stories of death. There's all, like, anytime someone experiences something as a profound loss, to me is legitimate, and it's okay to grieve it. You know, your cat dies, or you lose your home, or, you know, your body is aging, all these things that become losses for us are legitimate. And so, you know, if we have fabrics of care, fabrics where we could think of that, you know, I don't know. I think that's why it was so incredibly profound for me to go through that, because suddenly I was like, wow, this is what I wish the world was like all the time. Why does it just have to be at these moments? But we don't have to hire professionals to do these things. We humans have the capacity. I mean, you mentioned Occupy. I think that's why Occupy was so, I was part of Occupy Philly, and I was really struck during the time, there was like 1,000 people that took over a plaza, City Hall Plaza in Philly. And a couple of days before, most of those people had never done anything political to that extent before. And there was a small number of us anarchists who had self-organized things, but nothing, you know, so we're all like, it takes work to self-organize, you know, and the entire assembly of almost 1,000 people, most of whom had never done something like this before, were just like, let's occupy in 2 days. And the anarchists were like, whoa, it takes a long time. But we got out, you know, everyone voted, and we got outvoted. So we're like, sure. And I was really struck by, within 24 hours, we had the entirety of a community self-organized. It was like, there was a medic tent, you know, a clinic, there was a library, there was childcare, there was, you know, homes, tents for everybody that had previously not, there was 500 people that were sleeping on that plaza without homes. And they suddenly had tents, and we had media, and we had, you know, food, and we had toilets. And look, within 24 hours, and almost everybody, no matter how messy and hard Occupy got, time and again, everybody said, I've never felt so alive. I've never felt like I could do what I'm passionate about, and it makes for a community. I've never seen something where everybody does what they love and we have everything we need. So I know we can do this. I know we can.
It's funny, you know, and Occupy is that thing, because it's like, that goes with what you're talking about, because we actually had to share space together. It wasn't like, uh-huh, oh, we showed up to the meeting and then we, you know, did our fuck the police march or whatever.
Yep.
Oh, I miss those. you know, it's like we actually had to be around each other. And so you'd be around people who you might not like under normal circumstances. But then, like, you know, after you're you know, all together in this space, we empathize. I mean, actually, there's so much fighting and craziness and insanity, but I a lot of those friends, I've kept most of those friends. And
Well, I don't want to say that Occupy was just like perfect. It was very messy in so many ways, because it just suddenly also showed how we are all products also of a society that's structured on white supremacy and hierarchy and, you know, and all those behaviors came out. And it was, I always call these things like messy, beautiful experiments, is like toward freedom, is where we learn, like we practice a bunch of things that show us that we feel alive. And that includes a lot of the messes that we're like, I don't want it to feel like this in the future. So how do we struggle the next time to try to figure out ways to, you know, do some of the things that were really messy, a little less messy, you know, I don't know, you know, we would have to, the whole of this, I mean, like experiments like the Zapatistas, which have been going on for decades, and their writings to me, the most beautiful poetry and political philosophy at the same time, is they talk a lot about, you know, each few years about, like, as we build a new culture, we're building new people. And as the new people become new people, they start creating a newer culture. And then the newer culture creates newer people, you know, and they, by newer, they mean more able to be empathetic and dignified and self-governing and egalitarian. And then that takes time. It isn't something that overnight. So of course, Occupy would never have, you know, Occupy in a vacuum inside a capitalistic statist world was never going to survive, but it was the beginnings of people understanding their own power to feel alive and to self-organize. So I just think these moments, and if we incorporate that more and more, like, I really think, you know, all of us are experiencing loss. And so if we incorporate that in mind, like, this beautiful story, I've just been hearing so many beautiful stories when I travel with this book. I just feel so honored to hear people sharing such gorgeous stories. I'm always just really struck by, and just thousands of them actually at this point. But one in particular is in one city, they were talking about how, you know, there was a whole upsurge of people ripping down statues that were Confederate soldiers or monuments to white supremacy, especially in some of the southern and eastern seaboard city. Well, all over the place, you know, after Charlottesville. And this one person told me, she said, oh, yeah, in my city, I think we ripped down almost every statue. She goes, but some of us who are part of a black queer feminist collective, the next day we went to one of the statues that really upset us the most, and it was gone. And we did this whole day of, you know, healing ceremonies and re-sanctifying the land and doing something different with the land. So it felt different because we felt like that statue took away a lot from that piece of land, and it took away a lot from us. And so in a sense, they came and they were grieving and mourning and celebrating on it. And I was really struck by that because, you know, most people was like, it's just the ripping down of the statue, but it isn't, you know, it's us trying to figure out what do we want on that land once those things are gone, you know. That was such a beautiful story. And if we just do those, we think to weave those into everything we do more. It's not just the tearing down, but the what are we building up, and including what are we building up when we lose things? How are we building up our hearts for the fight ahead?
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's funny because these are the kinds of things that Scott Crow is always, always, always talking about. Because Scott's a very good friend of mine, and
Scott's great.
As soon as we became friends, he was always like, man, you got to check out Cindy Milstein. You got to dig into her work. You've got to dig into it.
Yes. I feel the same about Scott. I feel like there's some anarchists that spend a lot of time talking about care and heart and prefiguration. And especially the ones that have been around, I really admire Scott and other people who focus on a lot of that. Cause that's shouldn't be as rare within anarchism, but I hope it's the tide is turning on anarchism. I feel like there's a lot of people focusing on care and mutual aid and the values that we want to see in the world. Cause that's what keeps me an anarchist and has for a long time, is not what I'm against, but anarchism is always this challenge to be like, how can we in the here and now try to, you know, practice the social relations and social organization that we want to see in the future? Like, how can we start trying those things out in the here and now, you know, that otherwise it's just all talk. Yeah. So Scott's one of those people. I really appreciated that.
Yeah. And if our politics are not rooted in empathy, then what are they?
Yeah. No, I just feel like that's a core cat. I don't know. More and more, I don't want it to lead to, it isn't empathy and therefore, oh, do self-care and remove yourself and just feel better for yourself. I think it's like collective forms of empathy, you know, individuals and social empathy. It's just really key, or collective self-care. I just hope that the impulse isn't that what's rebellious about our mourning is not that we become more individuated to try to better take care of ourselves, that we become both more individuated and more collective and taking care of each other together.
Right. Or incorporate that into like resistance, not have it become like some escapist. Oh, hey, we're having an anarchist crying circle. We're not going to struggle anymore. We're just going to deal with our emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. No, some of the most powerful things I've been part of, I was lived in the Bay Area before the eviction epidemic got, was another loss in my life, 'cause I love living there. There were so many losses, and today actually is the 4-year anniversary of one of them. It's Alex Nieto, who is a Latino man who'd grown up in the Mission where I lived in San Francisco, and his family lived there. And he was murdered on a hill in the neighborhood he was just eating a burrito, his dinner, which everybody in the neighborhood eats dinner on that hill, or eats burritos in that neighborhood a lot, because that's one of the key foods in that neighborhood. And he was murdered, a whole bunch of cops, some new person who's gentrifying that neighborhood called the police and said, someone strange is on that hill. And he was murdered within seconds. And today's the 4-year anniversary. And the minute he was killed is like, there was all these communal ceremonies. His family one each month were asked people to walk up the hill and where he was, to where he was murdered, and then walk down the hill. And then there was often community dinners. And today I'm sure there's a community celebration. I've been at the Bay Area when I was there. There were many community festivals because of him, and art, and people made a DUI grave, and many people came together and cried and celebrated and laughed and struggled and fought really hard to get a justice that still has not been gotten and probably never will from the injustice system. But again, it wasn't instrumental. It was just the hurt of, I think that was some of the most powerful experiences for me too, is like, where people in a neighborhood that are under assault, which, I mean, if you've been in San Francisco recently or that neighborhood, it's no kind of exaggeration to say it feels like a war zone given the wealth there. There's so much loss and people through unfortunate, awful, horrible, unnecessary losses and murders like Alex Nieto. People just come together outside time and time again to both grieve and resist and create community and be friends and be there for each other. And you can't separate them. They're not distinct moments. Like, you can't say, oh, now the demonstration and now the time they're grieving and now the festival. Almost everything I've gone to with Alex Nieto, and I'm sure again today in San Francisco, this is similar, is they're all woven together again in this just genuine, non-instrumental way. So I hope we can try to do that more often when we have these losses, is understand them, of us coming together over them and allowing the fullness of how we feel about them and how we want to struggle to make sure they don't happen to someone else. It was really poignant in the Bay Area, that family. I saw them at, oh my God, probably dozens of other moments where other families had just lost a family member to murder by police. And each time the awful club of families that had lost someone to police would get bigger, and you just watch how tender they would be and empathetic they would be to each other and come out again and again for each other. And they shouldn't have to be in that club. You know, it just, I feel like that's an impulse behind this anthology too, people shouldn't have to have deaths like that. They should, or lives of people that are left over like that. And so how do we struggle to make losses like that completely unnecessary and obsolete? So that they could have grieved their son, for instance, the parents, when he was died a more natural death, not a death that's structured by policing. So those are, I think, just beautiful moments that we should strive for. Just like thinking through, well, like, why can't we bring the whole of who we are when we experience losses? Not just like run out in the street and do a demo and then go home again.
Right. Right. It's funny you were saying that. I mean, it's not funny, but what you're saying about the Nieto family, and, you know, I'm sure it's like this everywhere, but in Denver, I've become very close with families who've lost sons or children to the Denver Police Department. And it is, you know, so when this chapter in there about Black Lives Matter as a form of public mourning, I was like, oh shit. Like, wow, there is power in that, you know? And, and it just like opened up these spaces for all, you know, for all these people, cause those people are still out there. I mean, the families of the Ronquillos, the Marshalls, the Paul Castaway's family, like those people are still out there, organizing. They're, you know, those mothers, they're still standing together. And it's like, they're basically in it, you know, in this struggle for life now, because they felt the wind at their back. They've, you know, not only are they empowered, but they have people working alongside them, and they know that they're part of movements that will look out for them in some way, in different ways, you know? Well, I know you have an appointment soon, so we should wrap this up. I guess we didn't get to all the questions, but so in your book, you know, you talk about Fukushima, the shrines on the border. Was there anything else in this book that really stuck with you, that you wanted to speak on that you feel like fits what we're talking about?
Oh boy.
Just find the audiobook.
No, you're right. Like, I feel like I read and edited and worked with, I mean, almost everybody. I feel so honored that people agreed to write for this, because it's really, it just opened up. Almost everybody experienced more losses while they were writing it. And when you try to write about your own loss and you can only write about one little aspect of it, you just remember a whole bunch of others. It's a really intense process. So I feel like I ended up, we did co-grief work trying to finish the book, but there's pieces that I've read dozens of times, and there's a few that still make me, especially, I think just different pieces will touch people, and, you know, certain ones speak in different ways. And, I don't know, there's ones that just have more and more meaning for me. The one on, Fukushima, there's a sort of a dialogue between two people, one of whom, she lost her partner halfway between the 3 years. There's dialogue over 3 years, and in between she lost them to a cancer. And I'm sure she understands that to be from Fukushima. You don't see that in the story, but that, I feel like that piece just keeps coming back to me more and more, because at the time Fukushima happened, I was around one of the two people that did that sort of dialogue a lot. And he was just talking about how, like, we already know in Japan, that there's no future for this world. We're already in a world where we're all acceleratedly moving toward loss. And so in Japan, people are, the resistance movement is both documenting its own sickness and death and expanding on its own self-care. And those are the two poles of this movement. And at the time I was like, wow, I don't believe in a sort of no future world. And it really, it struck me as so poignant that that's what a movement is about, documenting loss and accentuating care. And yet now I feel like with, you know, what's been happening in this last year with hurricanes and Puerto Rico being almost annihilated, and just increasingly, like, the amounts of quote disasters, which are just becoming again normal. I just keep coming back more and more to that piece, you know, the sorrow. And some folks that went to Houston, during the hurricane were telling me, about cleaning out houses down there. And they'd gone down there to do mutual aid, and you have to gut houses really quickly and throw everything in a pile out in the street right after the hurricane. And they were helping families do that because it's very toxic inside, and you can get really sick, and you have to strip the wall, like gut it like a fish sort of in the inside and throw it out. And they said so many people that lived in their houses for decades didn't want to do it quickly because it was the entirety of their lives being like gutted. And, you know, that image of gutted and thrown in the street in this heap, and then they had no life and no home. And so a lot of those people, a few of those people that were doing that, what they thought was mutual aid labor, said they realized they were doing simultaneous sort of grief work for people who didn't know if they had a future after that, how their house and lives had been destroyed. And, you know, they said they just, a lot of times, would take an extra day and do it really slowly with a person and let them stay in a house that was really unhealthy, because they knew that if they didn't, that person wouldn't be able to process the loss. And I was just really struck by the tenderness of that, you know? So I come back to that Fukushima story, or, you know, some of the other stories. I was, in Baltimore about to do one of the book talks, and a friend of mine took me to a, a piece of land that's been squatted for a couple years now, and people are doing a garden on it, and some what do you do when you – we have fish that create some kind of permaculture with fish.
Hydroponics,
thank you. and they were building a bread oven and stuff. And she said, oh, they have a work day. So we did that right before I was going to do the Rebellious Morning Talk. And it turned out to be literally right across from where Freddie Gray had been picked up and murdered by police. And all around us there was murals painted to him being murdered by police. And one of the people that had started this garden had been in prison for like 3, 4, 5 decades. It was an ex-Black Panther, and he was there. And I was just struck by the intensity of loss and growth and beauty in this one place, you know? So I come back to pieces, like you said in the book, where people are talking about, not that there's silver linings to these things, but that it's, you know, when we intermingle our grief and loss, that we sort of see the poignancy and the bittersweetness of things mingled together. So another piece that I'll just end on, and that always moves me a lot, is one that is about someone who talks about going to Oaxaca and experiencing, and they live in New York, and going back and forth. And they went there with this wide-eyed, like, oh, it's so, people are so beautiful. The movement's so beautiful. There's so much art. Everybody's so wonderful. This is such a rebellious, lovely place. And one of their friends ends up being killed, as among many of the murders there, by the state. And they talk about that piece. I think what really gets me that piece is the piece is them at the end going back is like, anytime there's social transformation and revolutionary moments and rebelliousness, is the loss can sometimes be worse. Or, and so in a sense, they lose their naivete and they're more strongly a radical, but they understand the bittersweetness again of, like, to get to a better world, we're also walking through lots of loss. And I don't know, that piece gets me every time I read it, maybe because it just speaks to how I understand, you know, we struggle so hard in this world and we have some wins, and then we have so many setbacks and we experience so much loss, and it's, we have to understand that both are part of the processes of social change, even though they really hurt our hearts. So yeah, all the stories just, yeah, it's hard to, every time I go back and read it too, some pieces just stick with me or end up just speaking to me again on like the 1 year anniversary. Like there's a piece by the Nieto parents in there, and today being the 1 year anniversary, I'm just thinking about their piece today and what they must be feeling.
What a heavy, what a heavy direction, you know, you've taken with your work this last year or so doing this. You know, you must be like, how did I, you know, how am I like in this psychologically? It must be rough. It must be like
I think it's the opposite, actually. I don't know. I just feel like, people kept saying this in hospice, and I understand it completely, is everyone that does hospice work, they always go, I feel like this work is an honor, even if, like, you choose to do this kind of, I don't know, that it's an honor to walk into the fullness of what people can be as human. And like I said, every single talk I've always opened up space for people to share stories, and the hundreds of stories people have shared, and then letters people have written, or people have come told me that they've done things. We'll run into someone a month and a half later, and they say, oh, we did this, we changed, you know, we're opening up the space for us to do this where we live. And I don't know, I just feel like it's opening up the space for people to be empathetic and human and caring toward each other. And that's, it's the opposite.
That's awesome.
Actually feel more hope in humanity, not less, by kind of opening, walking toward sort of what feels like the truth of life. I think what drives, what's harder for me is when people pretend everything's okay, or we all have to be happy, or that, you know, we do political stuff and it isn't messy. To me, when we're like, no, this is kind of the beautiful, messy, beautiful reality. And yeah, the people's capacity to be good toward each other when we create space for people to really share these stories has just actually made me feel really honored and hopeful in a way that I hadn't a year ago, actually.
That's beautiful.
And I hope the same for other people too. Yeah.
But you know what I mean is, like, the tools you have to develop to, you know, to,
yeah, yeah,
to
no,
take
of course.
All that
I mean,
in.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I think I did one of these book sort of tours where I went to like 14 cities in 14 days, and every night I did one of these, and I think I must have each night heard, you know, 20 different stories that were really intense. And then people come up to me afterward, I'll stay at someone's house, and I'll hear a whole bunch of more stories that people don't want to share, you know, in a group. And I felt totally like I said, honor, like I just felt like, wow, people are just so empathetic and able to be dignified and loving and caring, and so many beautiful stories of the connection of grief and loss and resistance. And then I got home and I was like, whoa, I am so, you know, I just was, but you know, then you're like, okay, one only can take in so much stories before one's just like, wow. And that was also just really sad, because I guess I just, yeah, you know, the pain of it filled me up, you know, right? You know, because I try hard to be empathetic, and I don't know if I always succeed, but when you are, you take in, you know, you really do sort of feel other people's pain to some degree. So, but it yeah. was, it, yeah, it wasn't until I got home and I was like, wow. and then I just sat down and cried for an hour, and then I was like, okay, now I'm okay.
That's awesome.
But that's okay. Grief, crying is a good thing. I went to this grief group a long time when I was experiencing, I went to a whole bunch of different types of grief groups, and I was experiencing a lot of losses of death. And at one, it really stuck with me. She goes, you know, we always have Kleenex in the middle, but never, never push the Kleenex toward anybody else. Because what you're saying is stop feeling. And she goes, it's there for you to take it when you decide you want to, if you want to, but don't stop feeling. And I really hope that we don't stop feeling, because I really would just, again, want to reiterate that, like, we only grieve things that we love. So I want us to love more and feel that more and act on it more.
Me too, Cindy. Me yeah. too. Well, if people want to, you're active on social media. If people want to track you online, what are the best places for people to find you?
Oh yeah. Unfortunately, I'm probably too easy to find. I have an underutilized blog, which I want to start using again, but I'm easily found on Instagram or Facebook, especially Instagram right now, but I'm trying to write little things. Someday I'll get back to writing, and then it's a blog that has a lot of pieces I've written in the past about Occupy, and I was part of the Montreal student social strike and a whole bunch of other things at Cindy Milstein at WordPress.com, I think, or CB Milstein at WordPress.com. I don't even know my own blog name. but I'm definitely on Instagram under my name, Cindy Milstein, so you can find me there, or Facebook.
Awesome.
Well, and in real life, I tend to wander around to a lot of places, so hopefully I'll meet a lot of people in real life, including you at some point.
Yeah, come to Denver. Come to Denver. Yeah. Come to Denver. All right.
Okay.
Well, again, thank you so much. And I don't know.
Yeah.
Good luck out there.
No, thank you very much. I really feel really appreciative of you. You felt the book so much, too. It touched you so much. Thanks.
Up early in the morning, dressed in black. Don't ask why. Cause I'm down in a suit and tie. They killed the homie that I went to school with.
Damn.
I tell you, life ain't shit to fool with. Still hear the screams from his mother. Why my nigga lay dead in the gutter? And it's getting to my temple. Why is that the only time black folks get to ride in a limo? It makes me so mad I wanna get my sword in and have some bodies hauled. But no, I pay my respects and I'm through. Hug my crew,
what up,
and maybe shed a tear or two. Then I wanna get blitzed, grab my 40 years, and then I reminisce about a brother who had to be the one and only. So I dedicate this to my dead homie. Another homie got murdered on a shakedown.
Damn.
His mother's at the funeral, having a nervous breakdown. Two shots hit him in the face when they clapped. A framed picture and a closed casket. A single file line about 50 cars long. All driving slow with their lights on. He got a lot of flowers and a big wreath. What good is that when you're 6 feet deep? I look at that shit and gotta think to myself. And thank God for my help. Cause nobody really ever knows when it's gonna be they family on the front row. So I take everything slow, go with the flow. Shut my motherfucking mouth if I don't know. Cause that's what the pops told. But I wish he could've said it to my dead home. I remember, we painted our names on the wall for fun. Now it's rest in peace after everyone, except me. But I ain't the one in the front. Seems like I'm viewing a body every other month. Plus, I knew him when he was yay big. Pour beer on the curb.
before I take a swig, but something ain't right. When it's a tragedy, that's the only time that the family's tight. Loving each other in a caring mood. There's lots of people and lots of food. They say be strong and you're trying. How strong can you be when you see your pops crying? So that's why Ice Cube's dressed up, because the city is so fucking messed up and everybody's so phony. Take a little time to think about your dead home.